Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Baum.
Today we're talking to the artist and filmmaker Julian Rosefeldt. He'll be explaining the thinking behind his art how-to film Manifesto, which features Cate Blanchett acting out some of creativity's biggest ideas, from the Futurist to the Fluxus movements.
Plus, we'll be hearing from the musician Sudan Archives, whose music combines progressive beats, global influences, and a healthy dose of the good old-fashioned violin.
And we'll also be learning how to write well. And after years here at Monocle, it's high time we did, from the author and journalist Sam Leith. He'll be discussing his new book, Write to the Point, at the end of the show.
That's all coming up. Plus, we'll look at the news in the week ahead, and we'll play some good music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Here we are then, us happy band of brothers, Andrew, in the studio on a Sunday morning. It's been a while. We keep saying that, don't we? Every time it's like,
I think we're going to be here for quite a lot of Sundays in the weeks to come.
Dare we tempt our listeners with the can of Tennent's Super on the end of the bamboo cane that is our upcoming project?
Yeah. So we had the Summer Weekly newspaper. And annoyingly, you bought it, and annoyingly, you enjoyed it. So it's coming back for a kind of winter version.
Yeah,
we're going to be doing four weekly newspapers over the winter, which are already kind of underway and firing on all cylinders.
So we're talking a bit of ski season. We're talking a bit of snow. We're talking a bit of Santa. It's seasonal, but not necessarily all chilly.
Yeah, it hasn't got kind of holly on, and it's not being pulled along by a sledge. But
it does have a red nose.
But it has a bit of a red nose, and it's certainly going up to a high altitude every now and then.
We are its mother and father, after all, in certain respects. So of course it's got its problems.
It's a bit of a problem child, but it will come out good in the end.
Okay, nice. Okay.
It will find its foot like a good old mountain goat.
Okay, at the moment we're sort of mopping its brow.
Yeah.
In other news, what else has been happening? The forecast is sort of happening. That's also kind of rocking and rolling.
Yeah, forecast is happening. We should get in people's diaries that the Monocle Christmas Fair is going to be here in December. There's lots of going on in the world of paper and print. We have a couple more travel guides also kind of heading to the bookshelves. Yeah, just hold on to your sleighs, because there's a bumper Christmas heading your way.
On that note, while you've got all those dates in your diary and things jotted down, it's time for the news. Look ahead. And here he is. Tom Edwards, almost by royal appointment, I feel now, when you do the news look ahead, Tom.
It's been a while since I was in the looking ahead chair. I like to be back. It feels like being amongst old friends.
More of a throne, isn't it? When you come out to do the news look ahead now, there are certain sort of... Yeah, you've got a rider, haven't you,
essentially? My rider, it's extensive.
Yeah.
And glad to see that it's all been... taken care of.
I could hardly move. We could hardly walk in here, could we, Andrew? For
your ermine trim.
Ermine trim and bottles of kicking out of the way, empty bottles of Jack Daniels.
And my large bowl of just green M&Ms. You know, the kind of thing. Reasonable requests, surely, reasonable.
Now, news look ahead. What's the starting point this week?
Let's start at the bottom and work our way up, shall we? It's World Toilet Day today. Just thought I'd throw that in there. For a start, usual puns, flush with success and so forth. But actually, there's actually some sort of noble and important work that's done on that day, so just give them a shout out.
Well, it is because this is part of like the Gates Foundation campaign for everyone to have access to a toilet, and the diseases and the problems that go. You know, we forget in the third world there's tons of places in the developing world that have no access to.
Exactly, there are certainly things that one takes for granted. So a shout out to their noble cause.
That is a good one.
Let's move on.
Wipe our feet and move on.
I thought I'd quickly mention the Stack Magazine Awards today. Not our programme, The Stack, but our friends from Stack Magazines, who distribute top quality independent titles around the world, and they'll be recognising some stellar talents. And that's happening tomorrow night in London. So keep an eye for the winners.
Nice.
Are you going along? Are you nominated?
I was actually on one of the judging panels, Andrew. But I must remain still. I can't reveal the winners for my category.
442.
Well, who knows, Rob? The night remains young. Now, do you remember when I used to do these news look heads? I always managed to find extraordinary feats of athletic endeavour, desert marathons, and all this. I found a new one, and there's an Antarctic ice marathon. It's a regular marathon.
Wow. 42, done on foot?
42 kilometres, done conventionally on foot, but it's within the Antarctic circle. So people have to be flown in by private jet from Chile. They arrive and they tackle this utterly absurd thing. Underfoot conditions, snow and ice, minus 20 wind chill. I mean, that's going to be brisk around the old turntables, isn't it? Not even any penguins live that far south.
So this is a madness comparable with the Marathon des Sables, which is the one that runs through the Sahara Desert, right?
Absolutely. Isn't that extraordinary?
What would you be wearing? You're a keen runner, Tom. You're an athlete. What would you be wearing sort of downstairs? Would you be going for the very short shorts and just hoping that your pink legs would last for 26 miles?
Imagine the chapping that would go
the
on.
Chapping,
I think you need tights.
Would you lube up with Vaseline?
Big time.
Yeah. Like you were swimming in the channel,
absolutely. What is it? Goose fat or something that they put on?
When the channel swimmers,
cut themselves in that. Absolutely extraordinary. And people rattle around this in, 3 hours and change. Imagine being able to do that.
Well, you did a... He only brings these stories up so I can ask this question.
Yeah.
Because you've run a real marathon. You had a very good time.
Yeah, not bad, but that's just, pootling about on the streets of London.
What's your time, Tom, for the marathon?
3:18, Rob.
3:18. There he is. Decent. Straight off.
He's not got too bad, is it?
I think he's got a 3:18 tattoo.
Nothing
somewhere,
scruffy about that.
Don't you think he's got a tattoo? 3:18. What's that? Oh, it's just the time I did the marathon in. I mean, if anyone wants to train for that cold weather marathon, what sort of conditions, other than presenting a programme here in Studio One at Midway
House?
Well,
I was going to say,
what is kind of great cold weather training?
Minus 20 wind chill probably feels like Studio
One. Doing the globalist.
Right now on a morning. Yeah, I don't quite know how you can possibly prepare other than maybe you go into a sort of walk-in freezer or like in Rocky, a big meat. What is that?
Big meat freezer.
Fight the meats that are in there.
On that weird metaphor, let us end. Tom, thank you so much. I'm glad we pushed the ermine chair and had the news look ahead from
Thanks,
the original gentlemen. And best source.
Very nice to be back.
Julian Rosenfeld trained in architecture before moving into art and filmmaking, and his video and photography work are now housed in some of the world's most prestigious collections.
But one of his most striking projects looks at the ideas behind art itself, the whole of art, not just his own. Entitled Manifesto, it features the Oscar-winning actress Cate Blanchett acting out various roles designed to explain some of the big ideas that have helped define art's history. These range from the futurists to the dadaists, the stuckists to Fluxus artists and more. And to do so, Cate plays everyone from school teachers to choreographers and newsreaders. And here's Cate in some of her many guises during the film.
All that is solid melts into air. To put out a manifesto, you must want A, B, C to fulminate against 1, 2, 3.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. All current art is fake.
Forms move and
are
born, and we are forever making new discoveries.
To the electric chair with Chopin.
Nothing is original, okay? So you can steal from anywhere that resonates with inspiration and fuels your imagination, okay?
And Julian Rosenfeld joins us now. Thank you very much for coming in, Julian.
Thank
Congratulations
you very
on the project. I think I'm going to call it The Project because it started off as an installation in 2015. It's now a movie in 2017. First things first, was there any other thought in your mind on casting?
I didn't cast Cate for this project. It was the other way around.
Okay.
We ran into each other already many years ago, 7 years ago in Berlin in an exhibition of my work. And there that very evening, just had the spontaneous idea to do something together. And that was the starting point for this in a way. But I needed 3 years to come up with this idea for Manifesto. And it was also accidentally that I reread some manifestos and remembered reading manifestos from my studies and thought that could be something to develop with Cate. And then a year later or something, I came up with that idea, confronted her, and she was quite shocked at first because she had seen non-dialogue work of mine and thought probably whatever we would do together she wouldn't have even to open her mouth, and then I came up with the exact opposite.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there are a lot of words in this. We've just heard a bit of the trailer there, which is quite a nourishing thing in its own way, right? So how did that work, writing that script? That seems like that must have been quite a collaborative thing as well, wasn't it?
I started with a lot of reading, basically reading hundreds of manifestos, out of which at the end I selected about 55 or 53, I don't remember the exact number. And these went into 13 text collages. So there's a lot of different voices, although there's just 13 scenes and 13 characters. And then at that point already, I fed Kate with all these ideas for the characters, and she contributed some other ideas. We had a long list of characters, and it was a hard bargaining between us to cut it down to 12 scenes, where one scene has a double character. That's where it's 13 characters. She said at one point, because it was hard to get time with her, she said, like, could we maybe do 6? And I said, could we do 20? So we ended up doing 13.
And on that time scale, how much time did you have together? Because, you know, you say there are 12 characters and very different characters from gender to costumes to settings. How did you manage to film it, I presume, in a reasonably short time?
In a very short time. We had 11 days with Kate and one day without her, and 2 days to prep costumes and makeup.
Although 11 days is quite a long time to get a major Hollywood star to come and work with you.
That's true on the other side, and that's why I was very grateful that she actually could give us 2 weeks of her precious time. It meant for us to prepare everything very precisely, and then she is just so extraordinary in her skills and brings along that incredible humor as well, that it was a gift and only possible in such a short time, because she can do things in the first or second take that, you know, it's unbelievable. Sometimes we had, of course, talked through the scenes and talked about the dramaturgy of each and every character and scene, but then when camera rolls, it was always an amazing surprise how she delivers that. Really amazing.
What was interesting about these manifestos is when you go and look who's written manifestos for art movements, there are a lot of manifestos that have been written over the last 100, 150 years. Which were the ones that you wanted to focus on? It feels like they have a kind of a political intent and a kind of ferocity in what they're demanding of viewers. Were you after a kind of link between them, that they were all revolutionary in their tone?
Well, what fascinated me was that they kind of all broke with the past, but they're not necessarily addressed the future. They wanted to talk about the present. And so for me as well, the question was, are these texts in any way applicable today? Do they have any meaning today? Have they been prophetic? And so, and if you read them, actually, there's not much politics in them, apart from very few that I put right at the beginning, after the introductional sentence from a quote, one sentence from Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels' Communist Manifesto that was very important for the artists. There's not much politics in it, but as artists are seismographs of their time and feel and sense things that are out there, but they can't prove them yet, they become political if you read them later on. And that's exactly what happened over the last 2.5 years. So my question was basically, to which degree are these texts contemporary and applicable? And what happened now in all the Q&As and talks after the installation and the film is that people directly talk about politics in the very political landscape where the film is or the installation is shown. So they immediately understand the political dimension of it, and they read Manifesto as a clear anti-populist statement, right? There's a lot of anger in this text, and populists can be angry too. But populists say nothing. They are just angry and loud, but there's absolutely nothing in it. And these texts are angry and loud, but there's a lot of poetry in it and sparking ideas and inspiration. And so they echo in your mind after you listen to them, and people feel almost activated by them.
Is there a bit of subtext there for you, Julian, as an artist, as a visual artist, as a video artist as well, that maybe the world needs some manifestos rather than this idea of the loudest democracy wins or the loudest voice wins in the democracy? Is that a bit of your own belief?
Absolutely, yeah, totally. Things like manifestos have a little bit disappeared over the last 20 years because we can talk about our ideas like in this situation, for instance, right? Or we can have a blog or a panel discussion or something. So artists didn't really feel the urge of publishing their ideas on leaflets and throw them to the audience. But now I feel, and my experience over the last 2 years has changed that opinion. I feel that it's kind of time for manifestos again. And you can see them popping up everywhere all of a sudden again, because artists or other intellectuals have understood that in order to cope with the stupidity of populism that apparently is ruining the world at the moment, you need to use their tools, but in a very smart way. So you need to smart them out by just, writing your own manifesto, but an intelligent one.
Now, in a world where we often hear that kind of trite phrase, you know, the art speaks for itself, and many artists don't want to put any text or even a name to their artworks, these artists who felt that there was actually a whole manifesto to go with their work and their movement and the collaborations they did with other people, do you find that they are, on the whole, good writers, or they were better artists, or do you think that actually most of these people were pretty good at doing both things, at being dictating in text what they believed and in artworks as well?
That was, for me, the beautiful discovery, to meet all these artists that which I knew for their visual work, or mainly knew for their visual work, are also great poets and writers and thinkers. And then seeing the age of in which they were when they wrote those texts, very often they were written at a very young moment in their life. So they were just 19, 20, 21, right? So the visual work which made them later on famous wasn't even there yet. And so the manifesto is a statement that kind of defines the basis of the artistic creation that then only followed up. But through art history, as they became famous artists, those texts became also monuments of art history. And that's kind of a misunderstanding, right? So the text end up at the MoMA or at the Tate Modern right next to the visual work. But check out the ages when they were written, and you'll find and created, and you find very often the manifesto was there when they were just walking out of their parents' house and trying to understand who they were and what they want to achieve in their life. So they're actually not so secure as they always are interpreted and read, but they are rather fragile, insecure texts of a very young person who's rather asking or screaming inside, like, who am I? What do I want to do in my life?
Without turning you into a historian, when you look at that list of manifestos, you can find things from, you know, in just the last 2 or 3 years where people have done art manifestos about their movements. But actually, when you go back, it probably feels like you have to go back 10, 20 years before there's one that sticks in your mind as a movement. Do you think any of the recent manifestos will come to greatness, or do you think there was this period where artists were just more engaged and better at writing these things?
Well, they're still good at writing. I would say a few of the texts I use that they're recent are also beautiful texts, beautiful writings. The difference is that at the time, let's talk about the 20s, avant-garde, or even in the 60s, 70s, in the avant-garde times, the art scene was small. And within that small art scene, there was an even smaller scene of avant-garde artists. And then again, a smaller group among them wrote manifestos. And nowadays, there's a global, massive art world with so many ways to express yourself. And so I just think that these movements that don't crystallize as easy as they did at the time, or if they crystallize, then they're invented by people like Saatchi or something. I just say that this is a new movement. Let's call it like that. That's rather branding, right, than creating a movement out of the artists themselves.
What I wanted to ask you during your last answer was whether we see that we like the artists more successful, maybe commercially successful, after the artists have moved out of their parents' house, have written their manifesto, and have broken the rules of their manifesto. Do we like the art of the manifesto more, or do we like the art that becomes, that makes them perhaps famous and legitimate and wealthy in their own lifetime after they've broken the rules of their own manifestos?
I don't know if the text mattered so much for most of the people. I think we still read art mostly through our eyes, right? Seeing and touching with our eyes.
That's a very English language question.
The visual work that they created, yeah. So I think most people aren't even aware of those texts, and that is also another reason why I started to work on manifesto, because I found the writing so spectacular and so beautiful. It's basically also kind of a love declaration to all these words, and I just wanted to pay them tribute and kind of reactivate them, this text. And it's nice to see how the young generation now twitters out, uses, you know, although it's cut down.
So people are digging these texts now.
Yeah, they're using this text
for the first time since the 1920s or something.
Shortening down to Twitter times.
Now, the film is going out on general release, and this week you had a showing of it at Tate Modern. Tell me about the actual showing of the film. For you, does it have the same resonance when it's in an art gallery or in a cinema? Have you enjoyed its journey to different spaces?
I enjoy it very much, especially because it's a completely different audience that you're facing in cinemas. And it's also another work, although it consists of the same material, shortened down for the theatrical version to normal feature film length. But it functions differently. In the installation, you walk around and you're kind of editing yourself. You're deciding how long you want to stay in front of each scene. And you're also sound mixing by moving between the screens. And that is a completely different involvement. In the theatrical version, you're facing an audience who's used to be taken by the hand and guided through history and narration, and that narration doesn't exist. It's not even 12 or 13 short stories. It's just situations. And so we had to develop a kind of visual narrative in order to replace that. And that was created a different work. It's a trippy experience. I hope people listen to this can experience it. It's a different
trippy,
experience.
Trippy, says Julian himself.
Yeah. It's very trippy. You yeah. don't need to take anything before you watch it. It's going to carry you somewhere.
And how does it work with something like Dogma 95? That was a filmic manifesto. Mm. And something like Dadaism was obviously a famous sort of, you know, early 20th century art, visual art thing. Mm. How do those match up? Is it easy or less easy to make a film in the style of Dogma, despite the fact it's a filmic manifesto, than it is in Dadaism? As a visual artist yourself, do you find making something Dogma style puts a little sort of cage around you, whereas the Bauhaus or something else can be different?
Well, first of all, I think that when we listen or read these manifestos, we always take them or tend to take them very seriously. And I believe that, for instance, Dogma 95 was written with a great laugh. They had a big fun writing this. And it's actually funny that they themselves, in order to make it even a better joke, did two or three films following their own rules. But of course, they never took that serious. And I found it at the time already, when I read it first in 95, I found it very funny that people took it so literally and just translated. The artists speak in their language, and their language is art. And even if they're right, their language is still art. So everything is to be perceived in a different way, right? And so I would never take anything that serious. Although, of course, the you mentioned at the beginning, what did you say, furor or energy, or one of you said a word that they all have in common, ferocity or something. They have that drive, of course, but they wouldn't. It's literature, right? So the manifesto is art itself. It's not a rule like the traffic rules in London City.
Yeah. Okay.
And tell me finally, of all the cast and characters who appear, I think the newsreader may be my favourite. But was there one of the readings that kind of that stands out for you amongst all 12, or are you equally in love with all 12 Blanchets?
That's a really difficult question, because I, as you said, I of course love this text, all of them, although I don't necessarily agree with everything that is written there. I have a few favorites. You mentioned the newsreader, which especially made laugh the American audience, because I thought about Trump and the fake news debate. I love the teacher also, because the scene has the children that will bear with whatever we mess up at the moment. And so it has this kind of glimmer of hope at the end of the movie, and also contains the quote from Jim Jarmusch, his golden rules of filmmaking, where he says, "Nothing is original, you can steal from everywhere." And that's basically the recipe of my work as well. I stole from everywhere too to do this work, so I sympathize very much with that.
And that's a glorious moment, because we just heard that in the clip where she says that to the kids, and the kids all look up realizing they can steal whatever they want as their ideas. Thanks, miss.
It's got the ring of a manifesto about it, right? Love it. Julian Roosevelt, thank you very much.
Thank you very much,
for joining us. Manifesto is on selected screens across the UK from the 24th of November and elsewhere, widely available on all the usual channels. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you very much too.
In a moment, we'll be hearing from the musician Sudan Archives. So before that, let's have a listen. This is from her recent excellent self-titled EP. This is Come My Way. I can't jump high, but I hear all the notes. I can't be you, no. I can't be you, but I can be true, no.
That was Sudan Archives with Come My Way. The LA-based musician was born Brittany Parks in Cincinnati and has caught critics' attention with her unconventional coupling of experimental beats to self-taught violin.
It's also caught the attention of the much-lauded record label Stone's Throw, who released her debut EP this year, featuring sounds influenced by everything from Irish folk to traditional African melodies. Tom began by asking her how putting the violin over electronic music first came about.
Well, to be honest, coming from a violinist perspective, I just wanted to try something new. Like, at first I felt insecure about it, and it was just a personal hobby that I wanted to do on my own, creating my own beats and adding violin. I would never let anyone listen to it, but artists like Stravinsky, who's a classical composer who was kind of in the same boat, he was an oddball, and he incorporated classical music with his compositions, and he really did something different, and at first people didn't like it, but now he is a legend, and that's something that I want to do with my music, and I decided to stand my ground and to show people the music, and I'm just so happy that people are resonating with it, because my main goal is just to make people think more open-mindedly.
And you grew up in Cincinnati, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about some of the influences that are in that city. I mean, because what you've sort of done, I mean, and it's you know, as clearly as it's in the name of your sort of musical moniker, you're trying to bring some of these styles from Africa as well into your music. Was that something that was feeding into Cincinnati, or was that something that you had to sort of go out and find, you know, just on the internet, or how did you come across that sort of that input?
Well, strangely, it all kind of loops all in together at one. When a group of fiddlers came to my middle school, they played the violin differently. It was more so on a folk vibe than classical, and that's what really blossomed the idea of playing the violin in a more jittery, fun way. Coincidentally, most African music sounds like Irish jigs and folk music, so it's just kind of cool that it all blends in together and they all branch from the same type of music, which is blues music.
When people hear your music, that's a really important quality, I think, the playfulness, because it's not like trying to like jam a violin into a drum machine and sort of some monstrosity coming out. It's this like, it feels really fun and it feels pretty natural, and I think that's probably what surprises people the most. They're just like, oh, why didn't we do this earlier?
Right, yeah, people are very surprised when they hear the EP. And what I like most about the feedback that I've been getting is how people perceive like the way the violin hears. On Golden City, someone told me that the violin sounded like bagpipes. And I thought that that was like very interesting, because I feel like that means I'm breaking the conventional standards of what the violin even sounds like. So I'm just very grateful that I get to actually be the one to start that movement. I want to start an avant-garde R&B mixed with influences of music genre, and I can't believe this is all happening, actually. No, I'm not sorry for makeup, it's not here to stay.
I mean, you're signed to Stone's Throw. I did have the pleasure of interviewing Peanut Butter Wolf in this very studio once, I think.
Oh, wow.
But that's a really prestigious label. How did that connection come about?
When I moved to Los Angeles, I was juggling two jobs and going to school. I had no intentions of really believing that I could basically meet someone to get a record deal and everything, but on my fun times, I did go to experimental Los Angeles beat scene shows and ran into Matthew David, who is an A&R for Stones the Records, and chatted with him for a little bit, and he was just very interested that I was a violinist and I was so passionate about electronic music. So a year after, because I was so nervous, I sent him a song and I was interested in him engineering it for me, because I just wanted to put something on Bandcamp and stand my ground and just put out the music in the universe and see what happens. And when I did, he said that he was blown away. And the track I sent him was actually Come My Way. Peanut Butter Wolf heard it and decided to sign me off of one song.
That's a pretty good sort of in to a record label, just one song and then you're in. That shows quality,
yeah.
I guess.
Peanut Butter Wolf actually told me that that's what happened with Mary Hawthorne. So.
And you were mentioning there some of the beats as well, and I think people get really hung up on the violin. They're like, oh my God, what's a violin doing in there? But actually, there's so much more to these songs than just that. I mean, what kind of producers are you inspired by, like contemporary producers and stuff? Who sort of feeds your inspiration there?
A lot of producers off of Stonesoe influenced me, J Dilla and Madlib, and just people on the rise like K Trinata and such like that. But what I really want people to understand and like maybe take a look into is that most hip hop music, R&B, is full of violin strings. And what I'm doing is I'm just taking that sound and just placing it on top.
I was doing a tiny bit of research and I was on the Stones Throw website and I saw a quote from you saying that you don't want to be a pop artist, you want to be something else. I mean this in a completely complimentary way. To me, I think some of the best pop songwriters are people trying to be something else, you know, like people who are trying to go elsewhere.
Yeah, you're right.
And I don't think pop's a dirty word. I think it's a good
thing. I don't
think
it's a dirty word either. I'm now figuring out that it just means popular. And like, for example, Grimes, she's an electronic producer, singer. I like what she said. She mentioned that she's just trying to bring the idea of the producer, singer, and the performer all together in one. It's just a shame that most producers who make hits for the artist, the singer, they get kind of like pushed under the bus. But I really want to bring all of those people together in one person and just present it as it is.
Yeah, and when you do present it, you're playing live shows at the moment. What's the setup there? I mean, is it sort of a minimal thing? Is it just kind of, you know, a little bit of technology and you and the violin? Or do you have a band? How's it working out?
Right, so right now, this is my first European tour, and I'm so excited. But yeah, I'm doing everything at once. I typically have my SP-404, my electric violin, my mandolin, and I'm singing and dancing all at the same time. But yeah, if you are an instrumentalist and you want to be in my band, hit me up. Because that is something I'm interested in. But I think it's kind of cool to show people, like, this is what I do at my house. Like, this is how the music is actually made. Like, I hope you can, like, resonate with that. But I'm always open to expand and to add more members to Sudan Archives. That's why it is plural, because it's just me doing a bunch of other things. But I'm open for someone to, you know, incorporate what they have with what I do.
Sudan, thank you very much for joining us. Best of luck with the tour and the record and everything in the future.
Thank you.
Sudan Archives there, speaking to our producer Tom Hall a little earlier, and her self-titled EP is out now on Stones Throw Records, and you are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. Journalist and author Sam Leith is the literary editor for The Spectator magazine, as well as having been a judge in the past for the Man Booker Prize. So it's fair to say he knows a few things about what makes a good read.
And his latest book tries to distill just that. Right to the Point explains everything from letter writing to blogging. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco met him to talk all about it.
Sam Leith, it's a pleasure to welcome here at Monocle 24. And you have a interesting book, and I think it's a useful guide how to use good language in some ways. To be honest, this is something that actually is extremely relevant, because even in this new social media world, even if you're going to write a tweet, depending on the language you use, you might get fired or your career might be severely damaged. So do you think in this new kind of digital era or whatever you call it, actually the right use of words is more important as ever?
I think it's just as important as ever, maybe more so. I mean, people, you know, there's a sort of common complaint that goes on, oh, you know, people, the world's becoming illiterate, people aren't using text, children are losing the habit of reading and writing. And I think actually the opposite is the case. I mean, that might have been something you could argue in the 80s and 90s, you know, before the internet came along and, you know, the competition to the written word was, you know, television and the telephone. But now we actually, everybody engages with text all the time. And the internet is primarily a text-based kind of thing, and social media, it's all about, you know, written language and reading and writing. Children are reading constantly. They might not be reading dead tree books in the way that they used to, though I hope they're doing that as well. But we are looking at a huge, not only a huge exposure to text and written language, but a sort of much more complex exposure. I mean, I think, you know, the register, and this is one of the things that I try and get at in my book, is that the way you use language, the way you write, always has to think about what the audience is. And that audience will be expecting something different from a tweet or a text message than they will from something like a kind of formal business letter or an essay or a memoir or whatever it is. So it's all about being able to master lots of different registers. But those skills are no less applicable to the kind of apparently on the hoof, conversational, informal style of social media or the internet than they are to the more formal stuff.
Well, you know, looking at your book and you know what you wrote previously, you come across quite liberal in the way we use grammar, which is quite different from some other scholars who are very conservative. You know, you have to use, there's only one way of doing things. Would you say so?
I think that's true. I mean, I think this question of, you know, whether there's one way to spell and one way to punctuate and, you know, one way to form sentences, it occupies a really disproportionate amount of the public conversation about language. You know, people get so kind of angry about people who misuse apostrophes or use the word decimate wrongly. And they say, well, you know, you can't mean decimate. It doesn't mean annihilate. It means to kill one man in 10 in a Roman legion. And I'm of the sort of descriptivist end of things in that I think what you need to do is accept that there isn't anyone setting the rules for language. Language is something that evolves. It's something that's, you know, the sum of all the usages that people have in all the sort of range of different Englishes. On the other hand, which is again where the audience-centred part of my book comes, I say, fine, it may be pure folktale that you shouldn't split an infinitive or that, you know, the comma splice is always wrong, which is, you know, run-on sentence where you have two subjects and two main verbs in the same sentence. But a huge number of people in formal situations place quite a high premium on so-called correctness. And so if you're setting out not to win an argument with an academic grammarian, but to persuade an audience, come dressed to the party right. So getting stuff, as it were, formally correct, using the conventions of standard English grammar, is a very useful way of proceeding, you know, if you're writing formal language. And I mean, a lot of the informal registers we have, you know, a lot of the sort of social media stuff, a lot of email etiquette is much closer to the spoken language, which of course has a different grammar from the sort of formal written English. So it's about horses for courses. It's about knowing when to change gear and being aware that probably if you're writing an essay at university or you're writing a job application letter, you're probably best off being more formal and making sure that your grammar's sort of, as it were, dead on.
And I got to be honest, and I'm going to share something personal here. I had to do a visa application form recently, and I had to use very formal language. But I have to say my job, it's very, quite informal, I have to say. And I didn't know how to start the letter because, I heard, for example, you shouldn't say dear sir, madam. Apparently it's quite old-fashioned. So how would you start a letter like this?
Well, I don't know. I sometimes think dear sir, madam is a perfectly good way of starting a letter. I mean, one of the points I make in the book is if you're writing, say, a job application letter, in the age of Google, it's very often possible to find out the name of the person, you know, the HR recruitment person or whoever it is that you're writing to. And if you can do, you should, and you should write to them by name because you're already one up on the candidate who hasn't bothered. But in certain cases, you're writing to a large company, you know, it's a letter of complaint to a, you know, complaints department or whatever, you know, they're not keen on giving out the names of the people who run those things. So sometimes you do have to find a kind of, as it were, general opening. I think dear sir doesn't quite work anymore because it's, you know, using the masculine pronoun or masculine referent as the default is no longer considered, you know, okay. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable amendment to make. So, sir, madam, I tend to think sort of all right. I mean, I don't know what you'd say if not, you know, dear people.
Yes, you know, you can't, it is a tough one.
And I think for any sort of formal letter, if you begin with hi, comma, you're slightly on the back foot already. I think a certain amount of formality is a good thing. I mean, among other things, if you're writing a letter of complaint, you know, if it comes across as quite formal and even quite old-fashioned and forbidding, that sends a whole set of sort of messages, subtly connoted messages, about the idea that, you know, you're businesslike and organised, you're probably quite highly educated, and therefore you might be the sort of person who would consider using lawyers. So that might help to prosper your complaint.
We're talking a bit before. I'm also curious, of course, you know, you write in the English language. Would you say that the English language is quite adaptable in a way? Because, you know, we're talking about newspaper puns. Because, you know, I come from Brazil where actually I think language is extremely formal. And after living here, when I come back, it's like, oh my God, that's so rigid. And, you know, nothing changes.
The English language is incredibly adaptable. I mean, which is why a lot of the people who make grammatical prescriptions based on, you know, Latin and Greek kind of miss the point. It's absolutely omnivorous as a language. You know, obviously we're a little island that's had wave after wave after wave of, you know, invasions and, you know, immigration and movement of people. You know, we've had the Vikings and the Normans and the Romans and the Celts and the, you know, we're a massive melting pot. And our language is a kind of macaronic mix of all of those different influences, and we're notorious for these sort of loan words. You know, I mean, everything from sort of, you know, kedgeree to computer come from other languages. You know, if we haven't got a word for it, we steal it, and we're fantastically good at that. And I think so much the better. I mean, obviously, as the British Empire went round the world, it not only exported English, but it re-imported a lot of other useful words from it. So that makes it tremendous fun. You know, I'm not a, you know, huge polyglot. I've got, you know, a bit of Latin and Greek and a bit of Russian and a bit of French. So I'm not an expert on world languages, but I think it's fairly commonly conceded that English is one of the most sort of vibrant and busy and, you know, it's a sort of, what's the word, you know, one of those railway hubs or, you know, airport hubs of languages where people are flying in and out all the time, and so there's a lot going on with it, and it's moving constantly and changing constantly.
Well, talking about constant change, you also mention in the book there's a section for it about the emoticons as well. So,
oh yeah,
can it be considered grammar? I know it's a weird question, but
no, not at all. I mean, emoticons are on the kind of far edge of where I'm, you know, the material I'm talking about here, because they're not quite part of the language. They're sort of supplements to it. I mean, they're almost a bit more like punctuation marks than they are like words. I mean, I don't think they can be said to have a grammar exactly. I mean, you can create sort of sentences out of emoticons. I think Andy Murray, the tennis player, did a tweet which was his wedding in emoticons, which essentially started with, you know, sort of breakfast and went all the way through with, you know, kiss, dancing, music, champagne. There's a kind of structure there, but it's just a structure of this, then that, then that, then that, then that. I think where emoticons and, you know, their successors, emoji, you know, emoticons being the ones that are built up out of punctuation marks in a kind of old school way, where they're useful, which is where they originated, is in marking tone. Because in the much more kind of truncated and abbreviated styles of, well, originally internet message boards and now texts and tweets and so forth, you've got this very, you know, contextless little chunks of language going out. And so sometimes it's quite hard to tell whether something's a joke. You know, irony often doesn't travel very well online, which is why people who make a joke on Twitter that'll be misconstrued can suddenly find it going completely viral and they lose their jobs. So you see these formulae sometimes, like, I mean, it's interesting that people often now say genuine question on Twitter, because they realise that if you ask something, it can be seen as a provocation or an aggression, or as if you're asking something rhetorically. You know, you're saying, why do you think that? When actually you say, why do you think that? Genuine question, meaning, I'm not judging, I just want to hear the answer.
And emoji, such a minefield, right?
It's such a minefield. Yeah. And emoji can have that effect. So, you know, something that's intended humorously, you can put a winking emoji, or you can put a smiling emoji, or a cry laughing emoji, or whatever. And it kind of helps to sort of tag that particular communication as having a particular tone or register. So I think they're useful. I don't think, as some more extreme pundits say, that the arrival of emoji in the language is going to completely kind of displace the English language and we're all going to end up talking in emoji. I think that's nonsense. And even teenagers and millennials may communicate fluently with emoji in their text messages. That doesn't mean they're going to suddenly start putting emoji all over their CVs and job application letters and university essays. I think we can trust them a bit more than that.
And Sen, of course, I don't want to review all the secrets because the book is very interesting and I want people to go and buy it. But
excellent, me too.
Yes. But how to write a letter of condolence? I mean, I find it quite hard, you know.
Well, I think it's very hard. It's very tricky. I mean, in the book, all I can do is offer some more or less obvious suggestions, I suppose. But, you know, I've spoken to a number of people who've, you know, been bereaved and who've been in that situation writing letters of condolence. And I think one thing to remember is that it's the fact you're writing is much more important than anything else. You know, bearing in mind, you don't want to get into a kind of competitive expressions of grief. You're writing somebody who's in pain. You can acknowledge that. But if you kind of belabor it, you know, I think that that can be a mistake, because what they want to hear is, in general, something maybe funny, maybe irreverent, something personal about the person they've lost and something about what they meant to you. And if you didn't know them, you can write something much more general. It wants to be kind of 80% celebrating life and 20%, you know, sorry, they're gone, I would think, in general, because, you know, you don't want to state the obvious. But I think you needn't also be terrified of cliche, because, you know, some of those formal remarks you make, you know, those standard things, you know, my thoughts and prayers are with you, you know, if there's anything I can do at this difficult time, I mean, they are formulaic, but actually it's not the content of what they're saying, but the sort of form of them. They're saying, you know, this is what people do to signal care and sorrow and concern to people who are in pain. And the fact that they are a cliche means that, you know, they go across society. So you're kind of reaffirming something that's a sort of social convention. You know, they feel that a whole group of people, that a sort of, you know, social structure is around them. So I think as long as it doesn't seem glib or insincere, you know, that's okay. I don't think you need to think, oh, God, I can't do that. That's cliche. Because they're not going to be marking your letter out of 10. They're going to be just pleased to see it.
That was Sam Leith discussing his book, Right to the Point, How to Be Clear, Correct and Persuasive on the Page, with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. That's it, Andrew, for edition 437 of the Monocle Weekly. Did you enjoy today's programme? Nice, it will be all three of us sort of back in the saddle, right?
Very nice to be back in the saddle. And you should watch this space, because there's, over the coming weeks, Tom Edwards is working on a few little tickles to the show that he's going to be presenting. And the Monocle Weekly is going to be even more improved.
Is it?
Yeah, it's us with booster rockets on.
New and improved, or old and improved, either way. Either way, better than the real thing. Should we thank our friends behind the glass?
Please go for it.
Today's show is produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Tasha Kleeman and Chloe Karnazes. And our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. The Monocle Week will be back same time, same place, possibly same personnel. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.